We're holding on Chof Omid Bey's 15 lines from the bottom. We learned yesterday about how Shlomo sat on the Shlomo al Kiseh Hashem, the Pasuk says, Shlomo sat on the throne of Hashem. And in particular that, and we learned from that that since it says Ki Yodo Kes Kom El Chomel Hashem Ba'amolek, means there first has to be a Jewish king sitting on the throne of Hashem, meaning the throne that's dedicated to Hashem, and then after that comes time for the war with Amalek. So now the Gemara is going to bring another drasha having to do with that pasuk about Vayeshev Shlomo al Kiseh Hashem. So 15 lines from the bottom of Chof Amud Beis. The Gemara says, "Omer Shlokish, but Chila Malach Shlomo al Ha'Yoinim." Originally, Shlomo ruled even over the upper beings, so the Malachim and the Shadim and whatnot. Shenema, as the pasuk says, "Vayeshev Shlomo al Kiseh Hashem." Shlomo sat on the throne of Hashem. That means, in other words, he had rulership in a similar, in a somewhat similar way to Hashem's ruling over everything in the higher worlds and the lower worlds. All of a sudden, Malach al HaTachtonim, later on, as time went by, in particular after Rashi says after he married the various Goyish women that he wasn't supposed to marry. Now, okay, the Rambam says he was Megayer then, but still he shouldn't have done it, and it caused all kinds of problems. So therefore, so after that, then so after that, then he ruled over then Malach al HaTachtonim. Then he ruled only over the lower beings, only on earth. Shenema, as the pasuk says, "Ki hu roide b'chol eiver ha'nahar mitifsach v'ad Aza." He ruled over this entire side of the river from Tifsach till Aza, which are places on earth. So he wasn't so, but it wasn't before, it wasn't like before where he was ruling over the upper beings as well. What it means to rule over them? Well, we know that we have the story in Gittin how he controlled even the Shadim. Rabbi Yaakov Emden points out it means also that he controlled the Sorim, the Ruchnistika, the Malachim that. The Malachim that are the source of Hashpah for the other nations, so he ruled over them as well, and that way he's able to rule over those nations through them. And now it's just a regular terrestrial kingship without any Malachim or Shadim or anything or everything. So the Gemara, by the way, mentions when we say that he ruled from Tifsach till Aza. Now that's not the whole world. So what does that mean? So Rav and Shmuel argue what the pasuk means. One says that Tifsach and Aza are at opposite ends of the world. So it means that he ruled all the way from one end of the world to the other. The other one says that Tifsach and Aza were actually right next to each other. So then, what's the greatness of ruling over the two of them? Just as easily as he ruled over Tifsach and Aza, because they're adjacent cities and it's easy to rule over the both of them. That's how easily he ruled over the entire world. So one point Marshall makes the point, therefore, so then why mention these two cities? Because these two cities were well known as parts of his kingship. There is actually an interesting explanation. Since the world is round, then both opinions can be true. He ruled over Tifsach and Aza, one right next to the other. Well, when you go directly from one to the other, then you're going then you just have that. And if you go in the other direction from one of them, then you have to circumnavigate the whole world to get to the other one, and therefore you can say that between the two of them, they encompass the entire world. So the Gemara continues. So far what we have is two stages of Shlomo's kingship. First he ruled even over the Elyonim, and now he rules only over the Tachtonim. So the Gemara continues. All of a sudden, Malach El Al Yisrael. Then there was still a later stage when he's ruling only over the Jewish people. Shenemar, as we find a pasuk where he says about himself in Kehelas, Ani Kehelas Hayisi Melech Al Yisrael v'Gomer. I Kehelas, which is another name for Shlomo, was king over Yisrael in Yerushalayim. It says so as I was king only over Yisrael and not the other nations. Then there came even a further stage when he's ruling only over the city of Yerushalayim. Shenema, as you have a few pesukim earlier, and he describes himself as just a king in Yerushalayim, implying not even over the rest of the Jewish people. Now the pesukim are out of order. Maharshal says, fine. Sometimes you find that. But now, the big question is, what does this mean? I mean, Ben Yehoyada points out it certainly doesn't mean that the other Shvatim rebelled against him. We don't find any such thing anywhere in the Psukim. So what it means is, in other words, that they didn't give him the full respect of a king anymore. So originally, first, originally they're giving him that full respect everywhere in the world, and then progressively, as things got worse and worse, as far as his as far as his wives, and as far as the other problems that were being caused by them, so then you have less and less respect that was given to him in different places, in different places in the world. But obviously he still ruled over them, but nevertheless they're still not giving him the same full respect that that they did before. And then Ben Yehoyada goes on to explain that also that what it means is, for example, it used to be that all the kings from all over, everyone would come to Shloima to hear his Chochmah. Then eventually you have they stopped doing that, and only people from Eretz Yisrael are coming, and then only people from Yerushalayim and so forth. So there so it does, so it doesn't mean, as far as giving him the respect, it means coming to hear his tremendous Chochmah, where he was after all. So that progressively got less and less. Continues the Gemara. There came a point when he ruled only over his only his only over his own bed. As we have the pasuk, behold the bed of Shloima, which suggests that that's the only thing that belongs to Shloima at this point, where he's still fully Shloima, is his bed. So again, according to the first explanation, it means that everyone else is, even outside his bedroom, is not really showing him the proper respect anymore. And according to the second explanation, it means like only his immediate close people are still eager to hear his chokhmah, and everybody else not so much. All of a sudden, then there eventually came a stage when Ashbedai kicked him off the throne, as you have the whole story in Gittin. Loi malach el al makloi. He ruled over him only over his stick, only his walking stick. Shenemar, as you find a pasuk, Shlomo says on himself in Kehelas, this was my portion from all my toil, from all my hard work. This always means something that you can point to. So it means that all he had left was one thing, which is all he has left is one thing, which is his stick. So again, it again doesn't mean necessarily that. So now at this point, when he's off the throne, then yeah, it means more literally that he's only ruling. He doesn't have any kingship anymore because Ashmedai temporarily took it over.
But all this is happening. All this is happening. He sees slowly that he was at one point, and things are going lower and lower. He didn't question, ask Hashem, what is something wrong? What am I doing? Am I doing something wrong? To be able to fix the
Whether he
problems.
asked Hashem, I don't know. But did he take the lesson from it? Evidently not. I mean, people are very good at rationalizing what they're doing, right? The Gemara is going to explain later on that Shlomo was over on the three mitzvahs of a king, not to have too many wives or horses or gold and silver. But he figured, as the Gemara is going to say on later, on the I Reveloi also, I will be able to have many wives, and my heart won't turn away from Hashem and the various other things. So yeah, a person unfortunately can rationalize to themselves what he was thinking as he was going through all of this. We don't know. I don't think it says, but yeah. Now, in retrospect, he's mentioning it in Kehelas. I mean, Sefer Kehelas in particular, where you have a few of these psukim are from. The Medrash has different opinions in what order he wrote his Sforim. One opinion is that he wrote Kehelas at the end of his life. So in that case, he has now a chance to look back on what he did and to realize how badly things had gone. So the Gemara says, Rav and Shmuel. So Rav and Shmuel actually have an argument. What is it that he had left at this point after Ashmedai had kicked him off the throne? Chad oma makloi v'chad oma gundoi. One says all he had left was a stick, and the other one says all he has left is gundoi, which Rashi says and it means his talus. Then Rashi brings from Reb Hai Goin that the word is not gundoi but rather makedoi, which means an earthenware cup that you drink out of. So all he had left was that. There's an interesting vote from the Vilna Goin that says that those two things hint at that the really what does he have left after everything? He doesn't have his wealth, he doesn't have his power. What he does have is his chosim. We know that Shloima in particular made the takonis of Erevin and Atilus Yadayim. Those are among the Sheva mitzvahs Rabbanan. So now he has left his stick representing Erevin in the sense that you can carry a stick now in places where you otherwise wouldn't have been able to, and that Erevin themselves are made out of poles and sticks and whatnot. And the cup, according to the second explanation of Rashi, that it means a cup representing the Tilos Yadayim. There's also a vote that what does it mean he's a king? How does a person a king over his stick or over his cup? It means that even then, Shloima felt himself as a king and he still behaved as a king should, even though all he has left is these personal items of his. Anyway, so yeah, so there was a point when Shloima only had that. Now, Hodor or Lo Hodor, the question is, did Shlomo ever return to his kingship or not? Rav or Shmuel, so Rav and Shmuel argue, Chad Omer Hodor, V'chad Omer Lo Hodor, one says he returned, and the other one says he didn't. Manda Omer Hodor, Manda Omer Lo Hodor, the one who says he didn't return, means he holds that the order was Melech V'Hedyet. So Shlomo started out as a king and eventually became a Hedyet, a commoner. Umanda Omar Hodor, the one who says he did return to the throne, holds Melech v'Hedyet to Melech. He holds that there was a state. He was started out as a king. Then there was a stage when he was a Hedyet, and then there was a and then there was a stage again where he's a Melech again. So now, I mean, on the face of it, the Gemara is saying that according to one opinion, he passed away as a commoner, that he never became a king again. Marshall has a great difficulty with that. I mean, the fact is, the Psukim make it very clear he ruled for 40 years and he passed away as a king. So there's no question that he was a king at the end of his life. So what do you mean, Melech v'Hedyet? So Marshall says that maybe we mean, or maybe the opinion Melech v'Hedyet means, in other words, that his kingship was never the same as it was before. Sure, he went back to being a king, but not anywhere near the high level where it was before, that he's ruling Al HaYonim and so forth. And then the opinion Melech v'Hedyet or Melech would say that there was a time in between where he was a complete Hedyet, yeah, where he was kicked off the throne, but eventually he regained his full kingship in all of its in all of its senses. That's Marshall. And then different other Mephoshim talk about different possibilities in this as well, about whether it means that he actually whether it means that he actually was restored to whether it means, in other words, so Ben Yehoyada says, in other words, doesn't literally mean that he died not a king according to the first opinion. It just means that it wasn't he didn't have his great chokhmah and he didn't have his everything that he had before. It was on a lesser level than before, relative to which, in other words, some Melech v'Hedyet would mean, in other words, there was a period in his kingship where he's a king but he's also a Hedyet at the same time, meaning he's not as great of a king as he was before, as opposed to Melech v'Hedyet or Melech would mean there was a time when he was a Melech v'Hedyet, but then he went back to being a complete king with all of the trappings of it. Next, the Mishnah had said Poritz Lasis Loy Derech, that a king can break through people's gates and whatever to make for himself a road. As we learned yesterday, Rashi holds that this would mean even, for example, to go to his own properties. If there's somebody else's field in the way, then he can blaze a path through. According to the Rambam, it means specifically when he needs a path for his army to go through. Anyway, the Mishnah had then gone on to say that when it comes to fighting a war and they capture spoils, the king gets half. This, they bring all the spoils in front of the king. He gets half, and everybody else gets, and everybody else divides the other half between themselves. So the Gemara says, Tanan Abanan, we learn in a Braisa, Oitzris Malochim Lamelech, the king's treasuries, if they capture a foreign king's treasury in a war, Lamelech, then that goes straight to the king. Ushor Biza Shabozin, the rest of the spoils that they capture, half of it goes to the king and half to the people. So, I understand why the king's treasuries go to the king. It's a normal thing. These were in a king's treasury before, so it's only right that now this wealth should go to a king's treasury. Where do we know what it said in the Mishnah and in the Braisa that the rest of the spoils go half to the king and half to the rest of the people? So the answer is dichtiv, because you have like this. When Shlomo was anointed, the Pasuk says in Divrei Hayomim, Vayimshechu LaHashem L'Nogid Ulatzadik. The Pasuk says they anointed Shlomo in front of Hashem as the Nogid, which is another word for a king, Ulatzadik, and then they anointed Tzadik as well. So in the simple sense, it means, in other words, that they anointed Shlomo and Tzadik was present at the time. Or it means that they anointed Shlomo and then at the same time they anointed Tzadik as the new Kohen Gadol. But whatever, the point is, Makish Nogid L'Tzadik. The point is, the Pasuk is making a comparison between the Nogid, the king, and Tzadik, who was the Kohen Gadol. Ma Tzadik Mechtzaloy Mechtzalachav. Now, Tzadik being the Kohen Gadol, as the Gemara is going to explain in a second, that when things are divided up between the Kohen Gadol and the other Kohenim, the Kohen Gadol gets half. Af Nogid Mechtzaloy Mechtzalachav, the same way the Nogid, the king, gets half of what go gets half, and everybody else gets the other half. We learned, by the way, in Bava Basra, in a similar vein, if a person says that I'm giving my nechosim to Ploini, to Ploini and to the children of Ploini or something like that, then we said that Ploini gets half and the children of Ploini gets half, because by singling him out, it means that he meant for him to get half, similar to this. So The Tzaddik Gufay Min Olam, by Tzaddik himself, by the Kohen Gadol, where do we see that he gets half? So Tanya, Rebbe Omer, V'hoysel Aaron Levonav, when the Pesuk says about the Lechem Aponim being distributed among the Kohenim, it should be for Aaron and his sons. That means by singling out Aaron, it means Mechzel Aaron and Mechzel Levonav, half goes to Aaron as Kohen Gadol, and half goes to his sons who are the Kohenim had Yotim. So in the same way, in a later generation, Tzaddik, when he was the Kohen Gadol, would get half the lechem upon him, and the rest of the kohenim would get the other half. So then by the hekesh, that tells us the same is true of the king when they're dividing up the spoils. So again, anything that was in the foreign king's treasury goes straight to the king. That there's no division of, because there it's logical. It was in a king's treasury before, it goes to a Jewish king now. The rest is half and half. Now, we are going to learn later on that that a king is not allowed to have, we're going to learn on Omid Beis, a king is not allowed to have too much gold and silver. So how does that fit with here, if he's going to have, if he's going to be getting all these treasuries from foreign kings and whatever, he's going to have an awful lot of gold and silver. There is actually an explanation that maybe when the Torah asks him to have too much gold and silver is maybe only when he just raises taxes or whatever and he has too much of that. But if it's that he gets it, for example, by spoils of war, maybe there's nothing wrong with it. On the other hand, when the Rambam brings these halachas, he doesn't draw any such distinction, and therefore, according to the Rambam, you might have to say that, fine, he gets these things, and they go to the king's treasury, but afterwards, he's expected to keep only what he needs for his expenses, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, on Omid Beis, and then the rest of it, he has to give to the Bais Hamikdash, or give out to the people, or whatever. So the Gemara goes, okay, so the Mishnah says, now we know the king has three special mitzvahs, and the first one of them is not to have too many wives. Lo yabalo noshin. So lo yabalo noshin, he's not allowed to have too many wives. So what is the maximum that he can have? Ela shmona estre. The maximum he can have is 18, as the Gemara is going to learn out from Sukkim. Rabbi Yehuda omer marbuhu loy uvavad shalo yom mesiris es liboy. Rabbi Yehuda says he can have as many as he wants. He can have even more than 18, as long as they don't turn his heart away from Hashem. So, in other words, since the pasuk says lo yar v'lo noshim v'lo yosu levava, he should not have many wives, and his heart should not turn away from Hashem. So Rabbi Yehuda understands that that's a limitation. It means that he shouldn't have too many wives, because those wives will turn his heart away from Hashem, implying that if they're not going to, if they're all tzidkaniyus, then he can have more. Reb Shimon says no. I feel achas mesiras libay hareza lo yisena. No, if there's even one wife among his ones who's going to turn him away from Hashem and get him into avodah zara or other things like that, he would be also to marry her. So imkain loma nemela yabalay noshim. So what does it mean? He can't have for himself many wives. Da filu kavigayo means even if they're all tzidkonius, like Avigail, who was a neviya, she's one of the seven neviyas, then even then there's a limitation. So now, does it actually mean, are there two or three opinions in the Mishnah over here? There are different opinions about that. One way of looking at it is the Tanakhama is saying, by default, 18. If you don't know about them, one way, Tanakhama would be saying that would be saying that you can't have 18 because Mesiras es Levavai. Because they're going to take his heart away from Hashem. But implying, in other words, that then Rabbi Yehuda would be saying, so the Tanakhama would be saying, in other words, that if you don't know one way or the other about these women, then you can marry a maximum of 18. Rabbi Yehuda is saying if they're all tzidkonius, there could be more. And Rabbi Shimon is saying that not, the limit is 18 no matter what. So there may be two or three opinions in the Mishnah. Sometimes you find like that a Tanakhama will say a generic statement, and then later Tanoim will argue about that. So in other words, there is the Rosh and the Rabbeinu Yonah and others explain or say that maybe the Tanakhama is holding that you can have up to 18, whether Mesiris is Levavai or not. The Tanakhama may hold, even if they're among the 18, there are some who are not so good and they may turn his heart away from Hashem. The Tanakhama might say that's fine and he could still marry them. Whereas Rabbi Shimon would be saying absolutely not. If Mesiris is Levavai, you can never marry such a person. And according to Rabbi Yehuda, if they're all tzidkonius, then he can go even beyond 18. So there may be three opinions in the Mishnah, or there may be only the Tanakhama is making a generic statement, and Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon are explaining it. Okay. So the Gemara says, "Lememre de Rabbi Yehuda Dorish Taima Dekra, Reb Shimon Le Dorish Taima Dekra." So you're telling me it comes out that Rabbi Yehuda is darshaning the reason of the pasuk. He's saying because the pasuk is insisting that his wives not turn his heart away from Hashem, therefore if they're all tzidkanius, then therefore that reason doesn't apply and he can go beyond 18. And Reb Shimon says, "No, absolutely not. You can never go beyond 18." So Reb Shimon is not paying attention to the reason behind the mitzvah. The problem with that is we find that Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon hold respectively exactly the opposite. The Tanya, you have like this. The Torah tells us, voice sachvo beged almona. You're not allowed to take an almona's clothing as a mashkan. So what does this mean? So Bryce says almona benshi yaniya benshi hiashira. When an almona, whether she's poor or rich, now if she's poor, you're going to have to return her the mashkan every day, as we learned back in Bava Metzia. A poor person, for example, you take their day clothing, you have to return it to them every morning so they can use it to go to work. If it's bed clothes, then you have to return it to them every night so they have what to sleep in. So with this almana, whether she's poor or rich, ain't mashkin, and I said, you can't take a mashkin from her, shenemalai sachva begad almana, because the pasuk says, don't take a mashkin of clothing, the clothing of an almana, period, divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Reb Shimon says, no, ashiram mashkin, and I said, ani ain't mashkin, and I said, no, Reb Shimon says, if she's rich, then you could take the mashkin from her. If she's poor, then you can't. Because after all, if she's poor, you're going to have to constantly be returning the mashkin. You're going to cause her to get a bad reputation among her neighbors. What's this guy coming and visiting her every day or every night or even both, depending what kind of mashkin it was? And then people are going to start suspecting that something wrong is going on over here. But if she's rich, then she has many. Items, she has many outfits of clothing and many sets of bed clothes and whatever, and you don't have to return it to her on a daily basis. So then Reb Shimon says there's no problem. So you see, and so we explain when we learn in that in Bava Metzia, my karma, what does that mean? How does returning it to her cause her a bad reputation? Once you took the mashkin, then you have to return it to her every day or every night, as the case may be. And you're giving her a bad reputation coming and going all the time. Alma, Rabbi Yehuda loy dorish taima dekra, Rabbi Shimon dorish taima dekra. So it comes out the other way around. Rabbi Yehuda is saying, never mind what reasoning behind the mitzvah you might find. We don't darshan that when it comes as far as establishing the parameters of the halacha. The Torah says leisachvel begad almana. Period. There's no exceptions to that. Whereas Rabbi Shimon is dorish taima dekra. He's looking into what the reason. Why would the Torah ask you to take a mashkin from an almana? It must be because certain certain. Therefore, he uses that to deduce the parameters of the halacha. So there we see Reb Shimon does that and Rabbi Yehuda doesn't, whereas here in the Mishnah, it's the other way around. Rabbi Yehuda is Dorish Taima Dekra. He's saying that only because there's a problem, Mesiras Eslibay, implying that if all of them are Tzidkanias, then there's no problem marrying more than 18. And Reb Shimon is saying the other way around. So they're contradicting themselves. So the answer is, Ba'alma Rabbi Yehuda lo darsh taima dekra. No, usually Rabbi Yehuda does not darshan taima dekra. He says, never mind, whether the Torah says a reason for a mitzvah or not, we can't use that to limit what cases the mitzvah applies to. He says usually that's the case because the Torah doesn't specify the reason. V'shayni hocha, the mefarash taima dekra. Here, actually, the Torah does take the trouble to spell out the reason. Ma tam lo yarba lo noshim. Why is he not allowed to have a lot of wives? Mishum de lo yosu levare, because we don't want his heart to turn away from Hashem. So therefore, so Rabbi Yehuda says, the Torah itself is implying, unlike by the Almana, where the Torah doesn't specify the reason behind the mitzvah, here it does. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says, so obviously the Torah is implying, where the reason doesn't apply, then the mitzvah doesn't apply. Well, then, if they're all tzidkonius, and they're not going to be mesiras eslibo, they're not going to be removing his heart from focus on Hashem, then gezunta heit, let him marry more. Reb Shimon Amalach, Reb Shimon says, on the contrary, Mechti ba'alma darshin and taima dekra. Let's consider. Usually we darshin the reason behind the mitzvah. So usually, even if the Torah doesn't tell us a reason, we can deduce the reason ourselves and then use that to determine when the mitzvah applies and when not. So in this case, the Torah should have just said he should not have many wives and not say anything. And we would understand on our own. One second. That why shouldn't he have many because it would cause him to turn away. Therefore, Reb Shimon says here where the Torah gives the reason, fakir. It's not that the mitzvah doesn't apply when the reason doesn't apply. Just the opposite. The Torah is telling us two considerations. Number one, don't have many wives, b'chlal. And number two, by mentioning the reason, lo yosir, afilo achas amasiris libe, hareza lo yisana, because it means even any one individual wife who's going to turn away his heart from Hashem, is he's not allowed to marry. Elamani makayim lo yarba, da afilo kavigayel, and then the lo yarba means that he can't marry even more than 18, he can't ever marry more than 18, even if all of them are tzidkonius. So they're being consistent with their usual opinions elsewhere about whether Darshin and Taima Dikra. Now, by the way, both Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon agree, sure, we can, by all means, we can look for reasons behind the mitzvahs. There are Sfarim that are full of that. The Rambam and Mur Nevuchim brings reasons behind a lot of mitzvahs. The Sefer HaChinuch tries to bring a reason behind every mitzvah as much as possible. Everybody agrees you can do that. The question is, whether you can use that to determine when does the mitzvah apply and when does it not, then Rabbi Shimon holds generally you can do, and Rabbi Yehuda holds generally you cannot. And again, here, because the pasuk itself spells out the reason, then it comes out the other way around. Okay. Fine. The Gemara says, Hani Shmoina Estre Minolon. Where do we get this number of 18 from? So it's like this. Let's look at David's wives. David bonim bechevron. It says when David was ruling in Chevron, as we talked about yesterday, David was king over Yehuda only, from with his capital in Chevron for 7.5 years, and then the rest of the Shvatim accepted him as king, and he moved his capital to Yerushalayim and continued ruling there for 33 years. So meanwhile, while he was in Chevron, the pasuk says he had children. And they were as follows. His eldest son was Amnon, born to Achinoyam from Israel. We're going to talk about Amnon soon. The second one after him was Kilov, who was born to Avigail, who had formerly been the wife of Novel HaKarmeli. So you have the whole story in Shmuel Aleph, where Novel was a Rosha, and he was a stingy guy, and he didn't want to give David food, and eventually he died, and David married his widow, Avigail, who was a tzaddik. So he had a second son with her. Vashlishi Avshalom ben Macha. The third is Avshalom ben Macha, who we'll talk about Macha soon. Varavi Adonia ben Chagis. The fourth one was Adonia ben Chagis, who also we're going to talk about more on Omid Beis. Vachamishi Shvatya ben Avital. The fifth one is Shvatya from his wife Avital. So each one of them, in other words, we're saying each one of them gave birth to one son while he was in Chevron. So the fifth one is Shvatya ben Avital. The Gemara elsewhere mentions that the family of Rebbe was descended from that son. Vashishi Yisraam la Egla Eishes David. The sixth one is Yisraam, who was born to Egla, the wife of David. We're going to talk about later who Egla is. So in short, Ela Yuldul David Bechevron. These were the ones who were born to David in Chevron. So in short, David had six wives at this point, and he had six children, one child from each wife. Now let's fast forward years later. He's in Yerushalayim, and you have the whole story of Bathsheba. V'ka'omalei Novi, so now the Novi Nosson comes to him to criticize him and tell him off for what he did in taking Bathsheba, and he says, you think you don't have enough wives? V'imma'ot, if you think you have too little, v'osifa l'cha kahena v'chahena, then I can add to you like them and like them. Well, so far he had six. Kahena shis. So he has so far six. Kohena would mean another six. V'chohena shis, and like them would mean another six. So there you go. So the havelahu tmani sirei. So therefore, that gets you up to 18. Now, to be sure, by this point, the earlier psukim say that after David made his capital in Yerushalayim, it says he married more wives and pilagshim. So on the face of it, he has more than six at this point. But one explanation is that, in fact, that posuk is just describing eventually, during his 30-odd years of kingship in Yerushalayim, eventually he married other wives in Pelagshim. But at the time when he marries Bathsheba, he may indeed have still only had the original six. And therefore, the Navi is telling him that now, what do you think? You need so many more? Then fine, you could have three times as many as you have now without being over, but not going beyond that. So there's the different possibilities, in other words, that now and in fact the Orach HaNer adds also that David's wives are certainly tzidkoniyus, but fine. And according to Rabbi Huda, you could go beyond 18 if they're tzidkoniyus, but fine. He says this pasuk is an asmachta for the number 18. But in any case, the point is that and of course Bathsheba herself is the seventh wife now. But that's the point. The Navi is telling him, you married her, you didn't really do the right thing, so you can't say that Kohena V'chayena would be including her, and say 21, it means the six that you had so far, then you could have twice as many.
We're
Okay, so
speaking
that's where
here
we get the
about
number
we're speaking
18.
here about now David or Shlomo Melech, which
We're
one?
talking about David over here. Talking about
Okay.
David. Bathsheba was Shlomo's mother.
Right, okay.
Okay, Maskefla Ravina. So Ravina asks on that, why are you understanding it that way? Emo Kahena Tauti Srei. Maybe say the first Kahena means you can double the number you have now, which would bring you up to 12. V'chahena Estrim Arba. And then V'chahena would be double that amount. Namely, it'd be up to 24. So how do you know it means only 18? And in fact, the Gemara says Tani Nami Hochi. In fact, there is a brisa to that effect when it says Lo Yabel Anoshim Yosim Estrim Arba. There is, in fact, a pasuk that says there is, in fact, a brisa that says that lo yabel enoshim can be understood to mean up to 24. And the Gemara, by the way, points out lamanda dorish vova boi moshmoina havu. As a matter of fact, also another way of looking at it, there is a machloikas in various places in Shas whether we can add a whether we can use a vov to darshan something additional on top of what we had before. If we say that, then the vov of vichohena would add more, and then we would be up to 48 because we would say he starts out with six. Kohena would mean to double that would mean 12. Vi would mean to double that again and get to 24. And Kahena would mean as many as that, which would be 48. And indeed, Tanya Nami Hochi, in fact, there is a Braisa, Lo Yabel Enoshim Yosim Aboy Mishmoina. There is a Braisa that says that he could have as many as 48. Well, Vatani Didan Mai Taime, what about Ortana? Why Taka doesn't he learn like any of those ways? Fine, the Vav, okay, not all Tanoim, Darshan of Vav, but why Taka does he not learn like Ravina said that Kahena would mean to double, and Kahena would mean to double again, and you'd end up with 24? And the answer is Amar Rav Kahana, Makish Kohena Basra Kohena Kama, because he holds there's a hekish between the first and the second Kohenas. Ma Kohena Kama Shis. The first one necessarily means six, because you have no basis to add more than that. He starts out with six. Af Kohena Basra Shis, the same way the second Kohena also has to refer to six. So therefore, so it is six, six, and six, which is 18, and not any more than that. Okay. Fine. Okay. So far we mentioned David's first six wives. Now, we learned a couple of days ago all about the story with Michal and Shaul, all about the story of Michal Bas Shaul, and she's missing from the above list. David married her long before he became king, in fact, and he was and they were still together in Chevron. So you have to ask, Vaho Havoi Michal. So don't you have also Michal? So he has more than six at that point. You have the six that are mentioned in the Psukim that we quoted earlier, and then we know he was also married to Michal. So doesn't that mean that already at that point he has more than six? Although actually Maharsho explains that the point of the question is not so much that. The question is rather the question is actually the pasuk is mentioning the names of the wives he had. Well, what happened to Michal? Why is she missing from that list? The answer is Amar Rav Eglazu Michal, the sixth one on the list. When it says that he had a son named Yisra'am from his wife Egla, Egla actually refers to Michal. V'lama nikoshma Egla. Why is she called Egla, which literally means a calf? Shechaviva olav ke'egla, because she was as precious and as dear to him as a calf. In other words, you sometimes use animal nicknames as to talk about how dear and beloved someone is to you. So it means, in other words, that she was particularly beloved to him. The pasuk actually makes a point that they loved. The pasuk makes a point, which is a bit unusual when you're talking about husbands and wives in Tanakh, that they loved each other. So she was particularly dear to him, and therefore in this pasuk she's nicknamed Egla. And we see that the word Egla can be used of a wife. Shenemar, And we find by Shimshon where he says, "Lule harashtim ve'eglossi," if you hadn't plowed with my calf, meaning you have the story over there with you have the story over there with Shimshon, where right after he got married, he married a Plishti girl, he was Magaya her, whatever. But anyway, then he starts up with the Plishtim over there. He tells them a riddle, and he says, "If you answer me, then if you can figure out the answer to the riddle within the 7 days of the Sheva Brachas, then I'm gonna have to give you a whole bunch of suits and then whatnot, and if not, then each of you are going to give me one." And they can't figure out the riddle, and eventually they pressure Shimshon's wife into telling it to them. So Shimshon tells them, "Lule charashtem be'eglossi, if you hadn't plowed with my calf, then you wouldn't have figured out my riddle." So again, we see that he uses a calf as a nickname for a dear beloved wife. So the same way, egla over here means Michal. Okay, well, the question is, did Michal in fact have children? You have later on, the pasuk says, Michal bas Shol did not have any children until she passed away, until the day that she died. So it sounds like she was childless. Omer of Chista, fine. It means ad yom moisa lahoyala b'yom moisa hoyala. Fine. It means she didn't have children throughout her life, but then she had children. She had a child on the day she died. She died in childbirth, in other words. But the Gemara says, really, that doesn't work. Mechti bonim hecha kachoshev lahu, because the psukim that we quoted earlier, when they list David's first six children, his first six sons, where were they all born? It says in Hebron. Whereas the whole story with Michal, which finishes off with the part that she had no child, took place in Yerushalayim. So you have like this: the psukim describe after David came and set up Yerushalayim as his capital. That one of the next things he does is to bring the Arin to Yerushalayim. Up until that point, the Arin had been for 20 years in the city of Kiryas Yearim. Now he wants to bring it to Yerushalayim. We have it as after we have the story as after a pouch of Shemini. So he tries to bring it up the first time. He makes a mistake of bringing it on a wagon. Uzzah touches the Arin because he thinks it's about to fall and he's killed. And David stops the whole thing and brings the Arin to the house of Ovid Edom Agiti, who was a Levi. Ovid Edom takes care of it for 3 months and he has tremendous brachas. So then David realizes that it's time to bring the Arin to Yerushalayim after all, as long as we're careful with the cupboard of it. He has the Levium carry it like it's supposed to be, and they bring it to Yerushalayim with a tremendous procession. And the psukim describe over there, David is leaping and dancing and then in front of the Arin and in tremendous simcha, and the pasuk says, and the pasuk says, Micha bas Shol nishkava ba'anach haloyin, she was looking out the window watching, Vateres HaMelech David mefazes u'machauke lifnei Hashem, she saw David leaping and dancing in front of Hashem, Vatives, and she mocked him in her heart, she thought that it's not dignified for a king to act that way. And later on, when David comes home, the psukim describe how she tells him off for it, and David explains to her that no, my covet is not, doesn't mean anything in front of, in face of the covet of Hashem. And the pasuk continues, and then the pasuk continues with that point about that she had no children, and there's a connection. V'omer of Yehudavi, tamer of Yosef, shaklasa Michal l'mitayposa, means that Michal got her punishment by that, because she mocked David for dancing in front of the Arin, in front of the covet of Hashem. Therefore, she was childless and she didn't have any children. So we see that. So then it says, "Ad yom moisa," till the day she died. So you're going to say she had a child on the day she died. Fine, but the fact is, the point is, in other words, that from then on she had no children. So she may well have had children before that. The point of mentioning this shakla michal amataypisa is because otherwise, you without Rav mentioning that point. Without Rabbi Yehuda or Rabbi Yosef, mentioning that point, you might think the pasuk is describing b'chalal what happened to her. Now we're saying that no, as a punishment for the way she acted, now she didn't have children anymore. So you can't say that she only had a child when she first died. When on the day she died, Ella Ema ad oisemaisa hoyola mikan va'elach la hoyola, means for up until that point she was bearing children. Now from then on she didn't ad yom moisa. So in other words, yes, the child Yisroam, who was born in Hebron, which was years earlier. Yes, when we say that his mother was Egla, Egla is none other than Michal, and yes, she had a child then, and she had children later on for years to come until David came to Yerushalayim and brought the Aron over there, and this story happened. And then from then on until she passed away, she never had children again, except with saying that on the day she passed away, she did. So the fact that it mentions Egla as a wife of David who had a child doesn't contradict this.
So yes, his Gemara where Shaul took took her and gave her to this other guy. She took her after having children and being officially so married
No,
to
no, no, no,
point.
no, 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 no. That was, we're talking about that she had this child for David in Hebron. That was after David became king over Shevet Yehuda.
Right, but we learned that that
No,
Saul.
I know, I understand what you're asking. The answer is that no, that whole story with Saul taking her and giving her in marriage to Palti ben Laish, that was before David, that was after David had been anointed, but before David ever actually became a king, in fact. He's still on the
Uh-oh.
run from Saul during that time. Later
Okay.
on, after Saul was killed in battle, and David is ruling from Hebron over Shevet Yehuda, eventually he tells Ish-bosheth, "I want Michal back," and that was the whole thing that we had yesterday. And then, yeah, from then and then after that, so now David and now David and Michal are able to fully be husband and wife, and then she had a child, Yisroel. Yeah,
Okay, thank you.
okay, fine. So the question is, okay, so we said before that David had six wives, and then later on, and therefore Nathan is telling him you could multiply that twice over. The pasuk says that David took other pilagshim, and which we're going to explain in a second what pilagshim are, and wives in Yerushalayim. So it sounds, and that pasuk is written before, and that pasuk is written before the story with Nathan. So the answer is lamalo yishmona also. That's what it means. He took more wives in pilagshim in order to fill up the number 18. But nevertheless, when Nosson is telling him, kahena v'kahena, so again, one way of looking at it is that Nosson is saying, one way of looking at it is the psukim are written out of order, and vayikach David, oid pelagshim, and Noshim Yerushalayim is just saying generically, over the 30-odd years of his rule in Yerushalayim, eventually he married more pelagshim and more wives, but not that at the time of Bathsheba he had more of them, or you could say he did, but it means that the Navi is referring to the six that you had originally. My noshim or my pilagshim, what is the actual difference between wives and pilagshim? Amar of Yehuda Amar Rav, noshim b'ksuba over kiddushin, pilagshim b'loi ksuba over loi kiddushin. Wives means they're fully married. There's a ksuba and there's kiddushin. Pilagshim is that he takes them as common law wives, but like ksuba over like kiddushin. There's no ksuba, no kiddushin. They're just they it's agreed that she's going to be exclusive to him. There was an opinion among Rishonim, Rashi brings it on Chumash, that different Girsa in the Gemara over here, that Pilagshim also there is Kiddushin, but there's no Ksuba. So according to that, in either case, there would be Kiddushin, and then just in one case, there would be without Ksuba, without a Ksuba. There's a lot of discussion about that and about the details, and Bechlal, the Rambam holds that a commoner is not even allowed to have a pilegesh, only a king is allowed to, and the Ravid disagrees with that, and there's a lot of discussion about the ins and outs of that. There is, on top of that, when we say the king is limited to 18, does the 18 include pilagshim or not? The Rambam holds yes. The Rambam holds the total of 18 includes both wives and pilagshim. The Ravid disagrees with that and says no, pilagshim are not counted in the total. In fact, mefoshim bring that there's a pasuk in Divrei Hayomim referring to Rechavam, the son of Shlomo, the grandson of David, where it says he had 18 wives and 60 pilagshim. So according to the David, it works out nicely. The pilagshim, he can have as many as he wants. According to the Rambam, that the maximum is 18 between wives and pilagshim, then how is he going to understand that pasuk? So you would have to say either you'd have to say that Rechavam was over on this mitzvah. We know that Rechavam wasn't such a great guy anyway, but there are different answers about that, and the Migdal Oiz on the Rambam even says that the correct Girsa in the Rambam would also be like the way the Ravid holds that the Pelagshim are not counted towards the total. But there is discussion back and forth on that point. Okay. The Gemara continues. Omer of Yehuda, Omer Rav, Arba Meis Yelodim Hoyuloi LeDavid. David had 400 sons. What do we mean by that? We'll explain in a second. All of them were born from a Yifas Toyar, because we know the Torah says that a Jewish soldier in war is allowed to take a Yifas Toyar, and we'll talk about soon the status of that child. And they all grew their hair long in a goyish style. They would all sit in golden chariots, and they would travel at the head in front of David's army. They were the mighty men. They were the muscle of Beis David, because his enemies would be afraid of them. So in other words, the Gemara elsewhere in Kedushin explains they didn't actually go to war, but they would be there in order to frighten the Goyim. So one idea being, because they're the sons of your first Torah, therefore they had a goyish look to them, and especially since they grew their hair in the goyish style, so that would make goyim realize, hey, wait a minute, you know, previous enemies of David were defeated by him, and their wives were and their women were captured. So now, do we really want to fight against him and risk the same kind of thing? So therefore, they're more likely to make peace. When we say that they were David's children, so it doesn't mean literally they were David's. So I think Rashi mentions elsewhere that no, it doesn't mean David's own. It means from Jewish soldiers in his army. Each soldier would have a would have a Yifas Torah. And the point would be, in other words, that so the Yad Ramah points out that it could be that it means, in other words, that there were 400 times he went to war, maybe 200 times, maybe each of them had twins, whatever, and each time he took a Yifas Torah. But then there are other Mefoshim who explain that it means that that his soldiers, it doesn't mean they belong, doesn't mean they were David's children, it just means David had them enrolled in his army. The fact that they're wearing their hair in goyish style, again, as we're saying over here, is to frighten the goyim. There is also the point, as we're going to go on to say over here in the sugya, that the child of a Yifas Torah from the first bia is not necessarily considered a Jew. So therefore, because after all, even though his mother was Megayer afterwards, he was already conceived when his mother was a goyta. So therefore, they would even be allowed to wear their hair in that goyish style, and they're not actually considered Jews. Reb Reuven Margolius has a very interesting idea that in Divrei Yomim, after it mentions the six sons that David had in Hebron before, it mentions later on, it mentions another nine sons of David. And it doesn't mention a mother's name with them. So he says maybe over here it was supposed to say Tisha Yolodim, which means nine, and then somebody abbreviated the word Tisha to a Tuf, and then somebody else thought that Tuf means 400. Anyway. So these are more children of whether they're David's own or whether they're of his soldiers who were involved in his battles. Va'amar of Yehuda Amar Rav, Tomer bas Yifas Torah hoisa. So now Rabbi Yehuda also tells us in the name of Rav, Tomer, who was the daughter of David, was actually a daughter of a Yifas Torah. So the story is as follows. We talked about before when we had the list of David's eldest children. His oldest was Amnon. So now what happened is later on in Shmuel Beis, it describes that Amnon started having a taiva for his sister Tamar. So to make a long story short, he has her brought to his house. He has her come to his house under an excuse. He claims that he's sick and he needs her to cook food for him. And then while she's there, he grabs her and rapes her. Then the pasuk goes on to say that that later on Avshalom, who was her brother, as we said before, Avshalom was the son of Macha. This Macha was Yifas Torah. So Avshalom was very angry about the whole thing, and 2 years later he took his opportunity and assassinated Amnon. Anyway, it's a long, sad story over there. But anyway, so Rav Yehuda is telling us in the name of Rav, Tamar was actually the daughter of Yifas Torah. Her mother Macha was Yifas Torah, who had been captured in battle. Shenema, because we have in the psukim there, when Tamar is trying to talk Amnon out of doing what he's about to do, she says, you don't need to do this. Va'atar dabar no alamelech, or elamelech, it says in the pasuk, ki lo yimna eni mimecha. She says, you want to have relations with me, fine. Don't do it in a way of isur like this to rape me. Speak to the king, he won't prevent me from marrying you. Now, if she's David's daughter from a regular Jewish wife, fine, they're from different mothers, they still have the same father, she'd be an erva to him. So if she's saying that the king would allow it, then it must mean that she's not considered halachically Jewish. So if she was born from a marriage of David, then a sister is not mutter to him. Whether a half sister, whether from the father's or the mother's side, is still osur in the Torah. Therefore, you see that she was a daughter of a Yifas Torah. Now, Tosfos points out like this. When we say that a Jewish soldier is allowed to have relations with Yifas Torah the first time, does that mean before she converts or only afterwards? So Tosfos discusses over here, Rashi and Kiddushin seems to imply that only after that she's gone through the whole process of Gerus, the whole process that it describes there at the beginning of Parshas Ki Tse, only then is the Jewish soldier allowed to have relations with her. Well, in that case, Tosfos says, how does that help us over here? Fine, Macha is a Yifas Torah. But according to that way of understanding it, it means that Tamar couldn't have been conceived until after her mother was a Geyotis, and in that case she's Amnon's sister or half-sister, and she's still also to him. So Tosfos prefers the explanation to say that it means that the Jewish soldier is allowed to have relations with her when she's a Goita. And then afterwards, if he wants to keep her as a wife, then you have the whole procedure that it describes there in Parshas Ki Tsetse. So in that case, then fine. Tamar was conceived when her mother was still a goita, and therefore now, even though she's a geyoras, she's still even though her mother became a geyoras, and even though she was born already to a Jewish mother, then she's still mutter to Amnon. The other way of understanding it, Tosfos says, according to Rashi's way of understanding it, you would have to say that when Macha was captured in battle, she was already pregnant. In other words, she had been married or had znus or whatever, it doesn't really matter for our purposes. She was pregnant, then she was captured in battle, and then David married her as one of his wives. But nevertheless, we're still saying that according to that, she wasn't a biological daughter of David at all, but because she was raised in the palace from when she was born, then she's called a daughter of David, even though she's not actually. So two different ways of looking at it. The Rambam paskins like Tosfos' preferred explanation that the Jewish soldier is allowed to have relations with her the one time while she's a goita, and therefore that explains then Tamar was conceived from that, and therefore she would have been mutter to Amnon.
Even if it's the same father.
So that's the thing. Even though, according to that way of looking at it, she is David's biological daughter, but because she was conceived when her mother was a goita, therefore she's not considered related lahalacha to David at all, yeah. Okay, so the Gemara takes time over here to darshan a couple of the psukim in that story. The pasuk says that Amnon is feeling that he has a taiva for Tamar and he doesn't know what to do about it. So the pasuk says, "Lo Amnon Reya." Amnon had a friend, Shmo Yonadav ben Shima Achi David. There's a friend's name was Yonadav, the son of Shima, the brother of David. So in other words, this Yonadav was a cousin of Avshalom's. He's a nephew of David's. V'hoya ish chacham v'yonasan ben v'yonav. The pasuk says that v'yonadav ish chacham v'goymer. He was a smart man. So what do you mean smart? And he's the one who gives Amnon the idea to pretend that he's sick and invite Tamar to his house and so forth. So what does it mean? Chacham Amnon v'yonadav ish chacham l'risha means he was a chacham for wickedness. Usually a chacham means someone who uses this chachma for good. But here, unfortunately, this Yonadav used this chachma for an evil purpose to get to show Amnon how he could accomplish his taiva. With that said, the Malbim on the Pasuk mitigates what Yonadav does a little bit. He figures maybe it'll be enough for Amnon to see Tamar and then that'll cool down his Yetzirah. But if so, then that backfired. But you don't give in to the Yetzirah and then figure that'll help. But anyway, yeah. The pasuk continues. Vayomer, this friend Yonadav says, "Madua atakocha dal ben Amelech? Why you ben Amelech, son of the king? Why you're looking so thin?" And Amnon tells him, "Because I'm in love with Tamar." And Vayomer lo Yonadav shchav amatshchokha v'hischav v'gamer. So Yonadav tells him, "Lie in bed, pretend to be sick, and when your father comes to visit, tell him that you want Tamar to come make you some food." And tell your father that he wants Tamar to come and prepare you some food. And so the pasuk describes she came and she made him levivos, which are like kreplach or something like that. Anyway, so she took the pan and she poured out the food in front of him. What kind of food did she make him? She made him something fried. Now, what's the point of that? Why is that important to know? Ben Yehoyada explains, because that was all part of the plot. If Amnon had asked for food that's cooked in a pot, then David would have been suspicious. Wait, why do you need her to come to your house to make that? Let her make that in her part of the palace, and then she can bring it over to you in a covered pot. But here, where it's fried in a pan, in an open pan, and it would lose its heat quickly, then David figured, you know what, it's reasonable enough. She should have to prepare it in Amnon's quarters, because otherwise it'll get cold by the time she brings it to him. Okay, so the pasuk goes on to describe what happened. He grabs a hold of her and then rapes her. Then the pasuk says, "Vayisna eha Amnon sinu gdola ma'od." Amnon hated her with a tremendous hatred. My timer, what changed all of a sudden? Why did he all of a sudden hate her? Now, of course, psychologically, you could say because he blamed him. He figured he realized now what a wrong thing he had done, and he transferred it to her, etc. But the Gemara wants to find like a more practical, down to earth reason. A hair from her Eva got tied onto his Aver and made him a krus shofcha. It cut off the tip of his Aver, which actually would make it. He would be also from then on to marry a regular Jewish woman, but also it's a tremendous blow to him. So the Gemara says, okay, if he's saying it got tied accidentally, she didn't do anything to him, why would that cause him to hate her with such a tremendous passion? Ella, Rather, it's not that it got tied accidentally. She tied it. As he's doing this to her, she used the hair over there to cause him to wound him and make him a krus shofcha. So now he has now he hates her for that. So the one asks, Amy, is that so? How does she have hair there, Bechlal? V'hadara shirava, didn't Rava darshan, my dichtiv, what does it mean, a posik, v'yetzi lach shem b'goyim b'yofiech, the Navi Yechezkel describes the Jewish people, you had a reputation among the nations for your beauty, means she'ein lehen levnois Yisrael, le'seya beis ha'shechi, v'le beis ha'erva. Jewish women, at that time, before Churban Bayis tradition, did not have hair in under the arm or in the area of the erva. So how does she have enough hair to be able to do this kind of thing? Now Rashi brings that later on after the Churban, then you have Yeshaya gives a nevuah that it was as a result of the averus of the Jewish people. Then they're going to end up growing a lot of hair in these places, and it's not as nice. But back then they didn't have that. And the answer is now the Maharshal is bothered by him, and we have Shtei Cyrus and Halacha that are the symbol of that are the simon of when a woman reaches puberty. So how does all that work if there's no hair? So Maharshal says it means they had hair, but a very fine amount of it, not enough that you would have this kind of thing, except in the case of Tomer, as the Gemara is going to explain now. Maharshal says you don't really need that. All you need is we're saying the Jewish women would shave it. Fine, they would grow hair, but they would shave it, as opposed to the question is why Tomer didn't. And the answer is shiny Tomer de Bas Yifas Torah Havoi. The answer is Tomer is the daughter of Yifas Torah, so she doesn't have the genetics of born Jews, and therefore she had hair over there, and therefore all of this could develop. Ben Yehoyada even says that the hair may have been particularly strong and spiky, such that it would have the ability to actually cause this wound to him of Krus Shofcha. The pasuk continues. Vatikach Tomer Efer Arosha. Tomer took ashes and put it on her head as a sign of mourning to whatever of what about what had happened to her. Ksonas, it says in the pasuk, pasim asher lo kara, and she ripped the ksonas pasim that she was wearing. And she's going. The pasuk continues. And she's screaming out about what had happened to her. So Tana Mishmeder Bishur Ben Korcha Geder Godo Godra Tama Ba'Oseh Shah. With that action, Tama made a tremendous fence around the Torah. So it wasn't just that she's a poor girl. Look what happened to her. She got raped, and now she's just venting her anger, her upset and her hurt in public. She was actually accomplishing something with that. People said to themselves, "Libnois malachim kach." If such a thing happened to a princess, libnois had yotas alachas kama v'kama. How much more so that regular girls are in danger of such a thing? Im letznuis kach. If for a tzniustik girl, the pasuk mentions at the beginning. At the beginning of the story, it says Amnon didn't know what to do with how he's going to accomplish his taiva with her because the point is because she was very sneeristic. So she never was around the boys. So how is he going to have the chance until his cousin Yonadav came up with this idea? So if she was a sneeristic girl and look what happened to her, Lepritzis, Allah has kama kama, how much more so other girls who are not so careful to begin with such things? So the result was, Amar of Yehuda Amar Rab, Ba'oysa Shah Gazru, Ala Yichud Vala Pnuya. At that point, the Chachamim made a gzera, David's Beistin made a gzera about Yichud to not be in Yichud with an Eishas Ish, and about Pnuya to not have relations with an unmarried girl. The Gemara says, wait a minute, what do you mean? Yichud daraisa hu. To not have yichud with a woman who's also to you is also daraisa. So David's based in, there's nothing to make a takana about that. Remez liyichud min haTorah minayin. Where is there a hint in the Torah about that yichud is also with a woman that you're also to marry? Shenemar, you have when it comes to a mesis, the pasuk describes how you may have a person. You have a person who tries to convince you to worship Avodah Zarah, and it may even be a close relative of yours, and you have to bring them to Beis Din and have them executed. And the pasuk says, "Ki yisischa achicha ven imecha." If your brother, the son of your mother, tries to convince you to worship Avodah Zarah, what do you mean? This is the son of your mother. V'chi ben a mesis ben av en mesis. Do you think that only a son of the same mother would try to be mesis, but a son of the father, the same father, would not? Ella loy malach. So the pasuk is hinting to you, ben misyached imimai means a son would be allowed to be in yichud with his mother. His mother was an erva to him, of course, but nevertheless, a normal person doesn't have a taiva for his mother or a mother for his son, and therefore they're allowed to be in yichud together. So by mentioning ben imecha hints at that point. Ein echad misyachad im kol arayis shiva Torah, but you're not allowed to be in yichud with any of the other arayis in the Torah, which includes an eshes ish, includes other close relatives, etc. So you don't need David's based in a few hundred years after the Torah is given to make a gzera about that. So you're right. Ela ema gozu al yichud dipnuya. What it means is David's based in made a gzera that you should not be in yichud with an unmarried girl. Until then, it was only also with arayas, but an unmarried girl. After all, there may be at most there's an isu lav. At most there's an isu lav having relations with her outside of marriage, according to the Rambam. According to the Ravid, maybe not even that. But now, as a result of what happened with Tamar, they made that gzera. In other words, had that gzera been in effect in the time, then Tamar never would have gone over to Amnon's house, at least not without a chaperone, and the whole thing wouldn't have happened. So that's the thing. We're saying that when Tamar was crying and screaming over there, it wasn't just that she's venting about what happened to her. She actually accomplished something tremendous for Jewish women in future generations. Now the pasuk goes on to so now we mentioned before the older children of David. So far we talked about Amnon. Kilav it doesn't mention much about in the pasukim what happened to him. Yeshomim that he passed away young. The next one after him is Avshalom, and we know a lot about him from the pasukim. And the next one after him is Adoniah. So now let's talk about him. The pasuk is Vadoniah ben Chagas misnase lemer ani emlech. At the beginning of Sefer Melachim, it's an aftorah of Chayesara. Adoniah ben Chagas is raising himself up to say, "I will be king." So what does that mean? Raising himself up. How is he trying to be king? This teaches us that he tried to fit David's crown to his head, but it wouldn't fit. Namely, Rashi explains that the David's crown had a special shape to it. It had a bar running from the front of the crown to the back. So a normal person wouldn't be able to wear it. The bar would get in the way. Only if a person had a crevice in his head that would exactly fit, that the bar would exactly fit into, then it would fit him. So it was actually a simon. If a person had, if the heir apparent has that kind of crevice in his head, then he would be able to fit the crown on his head, and if not, then not. So Adonio is trying to make it fit, but it wouldn't fit. That's a misnasi. He's like raising himself up to say, "Ani emloich, I'm going to be king," but he's seeing that it doesn't actually fit him. Now, the pasuk continues about Adonia. Vayas lo rechav uforoshim. It says he made for himself a chariot and horsemen. Vachamishim ish rotsim lefonav. And 50 men running in front of him. So the question is, my revusa, what's the big deal? He's a prince. Fine, he's not the crown prince, maybe, but he's still a prince. He's entitled to have a retinue like that. What's so special about it? And the answer is, Omer of Yehuda Omer Rav, kulam netulek. These 50 men were not stam. What they did is with each one of them, they gave them some kind of potion that dissolved their spleen. The spleen is an internal organ. It recycles red blood cells, basically. But it's also, it's not necessary for a person to live. It's not a vital organ. So like this, and when a person has it within him, it makes him heavier. If he doesn't have it, then he's lighter. So Adonia wants these people to be able to run as fast as possible. So he had them all undergo this kind of thing to remove their spleen. Now, to actually do it with an operation might be dangerous, but in this case, he has them drink some kind of potion that causes it to dissolve. And he also had the soles of their feet scooped out, so this way they could run anywhere he wants to go, even over thorns or things like that, and not hurt their feet. So in other words, when it says vayas, he made for himself, meaning that he made that these men should be in this condition so that they can run in front of him as fast as possible. And so therefore, that's the pasuk highlights that. Maybe the point is to show what an achzor he was. Maybe whatever it is, the point is that he's trying to make himself king. And then Bathsheba gets wind of it, and she tells David to right away. She and Nos and Anavi tell David to right away have Shlomo anointed as king before Adoniah has a chance to do his thing. All right, the Mishnah says the next mitzvah of a king, lo yarbo lo susim, he's not allowed to have too many horses. So what does that mean? How many can he have? Ela kedei merkavta. He can have as many as he needs for his chariot, as we'll see in the Gemara. And the pasuk continues, v'chesed v'zov la yarbo lo moed. He's not allowed to have a lot of gold and silver. That means ela kedei litin aspanya. He has to have. He can have enough to be able to pay wages to his soldiers and immediate expenses like that. It means, in particular, Rashi says that he has to pay his soldiers on an annual basis, so he's allowed to have enough money for that. And in fact, Mefoshim say that that's what it means. He can't have more in his treasury than he would need for 1 year's expenses. Next, then you have a mitzvah eser for a king. The koisev of those sefer Torah lishmoi. Yeah, the pasuk says he has to have a sefer Torah written, and that means it has to be written lishmoi. It has to be written for his name. Yotzalam ochama metzia imo. When the king goes out to war, he brings that sefer Torah with him. Nichnas hu machnisa imo. When he comes back, he brings it back with him. Yoshev adin hi imo. When he sits in judgment, when he sits as a member of a beis din, as we talked about at the beginning of the perek, that a king from Malchus beis David is allowed to sit on a beis din. He emo, then he has that sefer Torah with him. Mesiv, and when he's reclining to eat, he kinegdo, he has it in front of him. So it's his constant companion. Shinema, as the pasuk says, v'ho yisa emo, v'kor aboy, ko yimei chayav, the sefer Torah should be with him, and he should read with it, and he should read from it his entire life. So the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, when it says, lo yarbe lo yisusim, when it says, you should not have many horses, yochol afilu kadem er kavte or farashav. If you only had, if the pasuk only says it that way, then you would think it means he can't even have enough for a chariot and for horsemen. Tamad loy, loy, no, the pasuk says, lo yarbe lo yisusim, and that means einemarbe. So loy einemarbe. He can't increase just for himself in order to make himself look big. Look, I have a lot of horses. But he can have enough for his chariot and for his horsemen. He has to have a cavalry in his army. Susim. So in that case, why does the pasuk say susim in the plural means susim abatlonin? He can't have any horses that are just idle over there and are just there for show. So any horses that he has to be for practical use. So the Gemara says, and the point is, another, because the pasuk says lo yarbe lo susim, and it says he shouldn't bring the people back to Mitzrayim. The man harbos sus, that he shouldn't increase horses. So first it says susim plural, and then sus. So the point is, it means, in other words, that he can't have horses that are just sitting there idle. Minayin chafilu sus echad v'obato shuv lo yarbe. How do we know that even one single horse that's there just for show and is not actually being used, that he's already over on this mitzvah of lo yarbe? Talmud lema leman harbos sus, because the pasuk says that he shouldn't increase a horse. So the Gemara says, well, if he's already over on one individual horse, susim lamali, then why does the pasuk need to say susim in the plural? And the answer is lava beloisa sal called sus vasus. Means it's over a separate loisa sal for every individual horse that he has that's extra, that's unneeded. So in other words, Tosfos summarizes that basically there are three things. You learn from that. If it just said lo yarbe lo sus, then you would think that he's not allowed to have horses at all. When it says lo yarbe lo susim, means that he's over on every individual horse. But then the leman harbe sus teaches us that he's over even if he has one extra horse. Okay, so the Gemara says, wait a minute. Timer to cost of Rahman loy. So you're telling me because the pasuk says loy, he's allowed to have enough horses for his chariot and for his cavalry. So what if it didn't say the word loy in the pasuk? Would you think that he can't have a chariot pulled by horses and he can't have a horseman in his army at all? He's not much of a king without those kinds of things. And the answer is loy tzricha la'apushi. The point is of the word loy is he is allowed to have extra. Apushi means he's allowed to have many, many chariots and many horses. He just can't have, so in other words, like this, he doesn't just have to have the bare minimum number of horses to pull his chariot. He can have more. And the same thing with his cavalry, with his horsemen and his army. He doesn't just need the bare minimum. He's allowed to have a larger number of horsemen, but he just can't just have horses that are there just bottle and just there for show. So Rashi gives a second gyrsa, not la'apushi, but la'apuchi with a ches, which means, sometimes you're riding on a horse. Eventually, the horse is going to get tired. So you take along, to begin with, a spare so that you can change horses after, so you can change horses after a while. That kind of thing is also mutter, because that second horse is not levatola. He's not just there for show. He's there for a practical reason, so you can switch to him when the first one gets tired. So that, we learn from the word loy, is fine for him to do. Next, it says in the Mishnah, the chesef is of la yabala el kadilit in Espana. He can't have more gold and silver than necessary, only enough to pay his soldiers. So the brisa goes through, the Gemara goes through a similar brisa. Tomer Rabbanan, the chesef is of la yabaloi, when it says he shouldn't have a lot of gold and silver, yochel afil kadilit in Espana, you would think maybe he can't even have enough for that pay. Tomer Rabbanan, loy, and again, the pasuk says, lo yabaloi, loy, ain't a marbe, he can't increase it just for himself to show off his wealth. But he can't have enough to pay the wages of his soldiers. So again, the Gemara says time to cost of Rachmana Loi. So what? Only because it says Loi does he have a heter for that? And you're telling me if it didn't say the word Loi in the Pasuk, he wouldn't even be allowed enough to keep enough of a reserve to pay his soldiers? How is he supposed to run an army then? And the answer is again, that he's allowed to have to pay them a generous amount. He's allowed to have enough in order to pay them bonuses and things like that. But he doesn't have to just do the bare minimum that he would have to pay, but he can't just have gold and silver there that's just for the purpose of showing off. Well, the Gemara says, Hashtad Amit Loi Lidrosha. So now we're saying by the horses and by the gold and silver, the word Loi is meant for a Drosha, respectively, that he can have extra horses in order to swap in the middle or in order to have a larger army or whatever. And the same thing with the gold and silver. Lo Yabel Loi Noshim my Daushis Bay. Then what are you doing with the word Loi in Lo Yabel Loi Noshim? And the answer is Lamaute Hedyotis. That comes to tell us it's a mute. A king is limited to a maximum number of wives, 18, as we learned on Amud Aleph. But a Hedyot is allowed to have as many as he wants. Now, practically speaking, the Gemara mentions elsewhere, the Chachamim advised that a regular person should not have more than four wives, because that way at least each of them will get Oina with him once a month. But in principle, a Hedyot could marry as many as he wants, only a king is limited to the 18, as we said in the Pasuk. Fine. So we'll continue tomorrow, Beis Hashem.